From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Every year, the medical schools of North Carolina graduate roughly 430 doctors. Though these graduates can be called doctor at this point, they are only about halfway down the long road to private practice. After med school, they go on to become residents for 3 years, and if they want to specialize in a certain field, many will go on to even lengthier residencies. Then, for some, there are years spent doing fellowships or other training. And the hours are legendarily long. Current regulations limit these residents to about 80 hours a week. The grueling nature of this training and the demanding instructors have made medical school a hot topic for television programs and countless debates. Yes, it's an endurance test to become a doctor in America, but should it be this hard? Duke's Medical School is ranked among the country's top six, and UNC Chapel Hill is ranked among the top 25. Each school has a reputation for difficulty or innovation or old-fashioned tactics. The question is, should changes be made in that system? With those grueling hours, what gets short shrift? Should there be more attention to bedside manner, or is there just so much that a med student can absorb? Joining us for the hour to talk about medical training in North Carolina and the U.S., we have with us faculty members from both Duke and UNC's medical schools. Ed Halpern is the Vice Dean of the School of Medicine at Duke University and is here in the studio. Welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you.
And also with us by phone is Alan Hamrick. He is Associate Director of the Counseling and Psychological Services at UNC Chapel Hill. Hello. Thanks for being with us, Alan Hamrick.
Hi. Thank you.
And we welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Whether you are a doctor in training, a patient who would face doctors and have had some experience in that regard, we welcome your calls. The number is 1-877-962-9862. Well, earlier today, we spoke with a medical student who's going to school in another state. He asked that his real name not be used. We'll call him Edward. And we asked him what he has found to be the hardest thing about medical school.
The hardest part, sort of the first 2 years of medical school, and this all is related, there's sort of a dehumanizing process that happens. On one level, you are learning the data acquisition. You're learning the language of medicine. So from that standpoint, you're learning about pathophysiology, you're learning about physiology, you're learning about how these organ systems work together. So you're not really getting a complete picture of the patient as a person. You're getting snippets here and there of what should be working and what isn't working and how they're supposed to be brought back together to be working. And the second sort of aspect of the dehumanizing process also becomes a factor because as a student, the feedback that you receive is largely numerical. You are being evaluated and you're receiving your feedback based on how well you're performing on exams that are testing how much data you've acquired. So you sort of get into a frame of mind of being like, the important thing is to be able to get the information. And somewhere in there, it becomes a little bit deadening because you're not asked to really creatively engage the material. I think that that historically has been the systemic problem with medical education, but several schools, and I have friends at a lot of different schools across the country who speak to the same thing, which is that schools are trying different things to humanize the experience of medical school. And I think that the first 2 years in particular are the worst in the sense of that sort of dehumanizing.
If there were anything you could change about the way future doctors are trained, what would it be?
I sort of have a dream of how medical school could be different. I'm sort of chuckling because medical school is not cheap. And you pay a lot of money to go to medical school, so the idea of adding time to medical school is probably distasteful to a lot of people. But I think it would have been beneficial to me to have had at least another semester within the basic curriculum in order to give more time to digest as well as or opportunities to engage the material more creatively, I would have benefited from having more time allotted for the ability to independently interact with some of the things that I was interested in. So rather than just kind of banging through the material in 2 years and getting to the end of it and being exhausted.
That was a medical student from another state who spoke with us this morning. He chose not to give his real name because as a third-year med student, he said he is still being evaluated and didn't want to take the risk of his evaluators hearing his comments and considering them when evaluating him. Part and parcel of some of our discussion today about the training that medical students get in the U.S. and in North Carolina. With us in the studio is Edward Halperin, who is Vice Dean of the School of Medicine at Duke University, and Alan Hamrick is on the phone. He's Associate Director of Counseling and Psychological Services and works as a liaison to med school students. Well, first, Ed Halperin, have you heard some of what we heard Edward talking about there? I mean, does that sound familiar? Do you hear this from other med students?
It's extremely familiar because it's the most common emotion of a starting medical student. People have an image that they'll arrive for medical school, put on a white coat, and become a doctor. And then they get upset when they confront the fact that they're nowhere near being a doctor, and they have a lot of classroom work to do. This young man in the interview you just played used the word dehumanizing twice and criticized medical education from the vantage point of being a few months into his third year of medical school. It would be nice if you could interview him again in 20 years when he has some perspective on the process. He says medical education's dehumanizing because he's learning anatomy and physiology and biochemistry and neurosciences. And what he's concerned about is he doesn't have the whole picture. Well, he doesn't have the whole picture because he's just started a very long journey.
Now, that's another couple of years in med school. Then in his third and fourth years, it's more hands-on, or at least being in a hospital setting, away from the textbooks and in a hospital setting.
Depends where the young man's in medical school. Some U.S. medical schools do 2 years of basic science followed by 2 years of clinical. Duke does a year of basic science, a year of clinical, a year of research, and then another year of clinical. But that's not really the denominator, the 4 years of medical school. The denominator, as you said in the introduction, is medical school, internship, residency, fellowship, and a lifetime of practice. And if you're really lucky and blessed and work really hard, there'll be some point late in your career, maybe when you feel like you have it all put together in a whole. And that's not dehumanizing. That's the basic fact that patients are perishable, and it's really hard to get this discipline. Very well done. Hippocrates told us that 4,000 years ago. The art is long and time is short.
How long, I'll ask this of Alan Hamrick and then come back to you, Ed Halperin, how long would you say it takes to get somebody trained to be a doctor who could deal with patients? I mean, how many years would you say?
You're asking me?
Yes, for starters.
Well, you've got the 4 years of medical school, and then you have residency training, which can be anywhere from 3 to sometimes up to 7 years. And then after that, you get a lot of good practice in residency and a lot of skills in residency, but I generally find that until a person's been out in their own practice of some kind after residency for at least 5 or 6 years, they're consistently learning more and more as they go. And as Dr. Halperin said, it is kind of a lifetime learning, but I think that people generally by the time that they get out of residency are certainly adequately trained to be able to take care of people. They've got the skill. They may not have the art of pulling it all together in a seamless fashion so that the patient has the sense that they're being cared for as a whole person, but they certainly have the skill to take care of the patient by the time they get out of residency.
There's often that comment made about doctors feeling like gods. Or God, depending on whether you're pantheistic or not. Is there a point when a doctor knows everything there is to know, or is it a matter of the time spent getting the training increases the odds that the doctor, he or she, will know what to do in the situation?
Are you asking me?
I'm posing this to Ed Halpern.
There's never a time when the doctor knows everything he or she needs to know. And with the growth of medical knowledge, part of the skill of a physician is the ability to access databases, clinical trials, textbooks, and journals. What I would add to what Dr. Hamrick said earlier is you have to make a distinction between the acquisition of technical skills and the acquisition of people skills. You can teach someone to do venipuncture, to draw blood, in a relatively short period of time, and to perform that technical skill with relative efficacy. But teaching someone how to talk to a person about having their blood drawn, their experience with it, how to interpret the results, comes with training and also with lifetime experience.
Is that the art as opposed to the science?
Well, what you just said is that the art as opposed to the science is the standard comment, and I suppose I'm supposed to say yes. But
no, you say what you want to say.
But I think that among the things we've learned in educational research is that many of the things that people called art, suggesting that it was a talent or a gift, are trainable skills. You can teach people how to talk to other people. You can teach people to be better listeners. You can teach people when to sit and when to stand. And all those things are not an art, not just something you're born with. They're things which are learned.
And we will return to our conversation about the training of doctors with Ed Halpern from Duke Medical School and Alan Hamrick from UNC Chapel Hill's Counseling and Psychological Services in just a moment. Our number is 1-877-962-9862, 1-877-962-9862. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Melinda Pencava, and today we are talking about how doctors are trained in the U.S. and the demands that medical school places on students. With us are Ed Halpern, who is Vice Dean of the School of Medicine at Duke University, and Alan Hamrick, Associate Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at UNC Chapel Hill. And we are taking your calls. The number's 1-877-962-9862. Jericho is on the line from Lewisburg. Hi there, Jericho.
Hey, how are you today?
Fine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So what's your take on medical training?
Well, as someone who's been through several medical procedures, one thing, I've been through three back surgeries, and one thing that I noticed throughout my experiences is that I think more focus needs to be placed on the whole bedside manner issue. As I was listening to the show, I heard many mentions to how medicine is a practice and compared to an art form. Well, as a lot of art students may know, if they don't learn to practice cleaning their brushes when they're young and start out, well, their art career isn't going to go too far, and it's going to be very complicated. And I think that, you know, if they somehow were able to work in the very into the very busy curriculum, the art of good bedside manners and communication, that it would improve not only communication but the whole sphere of medical practice. The patient would be able to communicate more what truly is going on in their body. For, you know, let's face it, they know truly what's going on in their body. And if they're unable to communicate it successfully, they're not going to get the optimal care.
Well, Alan Hamrick, did you want to comment on that?
Well, I think it's very well said. And it's, you know, I was interested when the anonymous student at the beginning talked about extending the curriculum, because we at UNC have thought about trying to put these types of things into the curriculum, but in order to be able to accomplish what a young physician or a medical student needs to accomplish, there's just no room in the curriculum in 4 years to be able to get these types of things in there. I mean, they're placed in such things as introduction to clinical medicine and social and cultural medicine. They're placed in those ways, and they are attended to in that way, but that's generally just in the first couple of years. And then once a student hits the wards and begins to do clinical medicine, it really depends on who they're with, who's training them about that. But it is, that is what I consider to be part of the art, how to listen to a person and be able to communicate with that person and understand what it is that they're looking for, even if the communication styles could be very different, even with what can be considered at times to be a power differential, and that the doctor can be seen to be somebody who should just be said yes to, yes, to whatever you want, doctor. And in fact, they really need to be encouraged to communicate and get their information out, because it is true. They frequently, the patient knows more about what's going on for themselves and can give some really critical information.
Could it be that they just have to be asked the right questions?
Sure, yeah. And sometimes even in the right way. And frequently there are cultural barriers and language barriers that get in the way. And it's the speed with which, I mean, medicine reflects what we're dealing with in a greater culture of just the speed of how we have to do everything, the speed of communication, the speed of information transfer. And we're in a place where if we are not stopping to just reject that speed for a while, sometimes it impairs the communication, because the patient's in a place of being there completely consumed with it is what they're worried about. And yet from the physician's perspective, frequently they're thinking about that patient and about the patient that's in the next 15 minutes and the patient that's in the next 15 minutes, and there are a lot of pressures on the physician to the point that unless there's a real mindfulness about it, it's very difficult to remember to take the time to just sit and be with that person.
Yeah. I was going to pose this question to Ed Halperin here in the studio out of Duke Med. Given the workload at hospitals that Alan Hamrick's just talking about there, I wonder, do docs even have time to sit? literally sit and talk with patients. Sometimes my limited experience is they're running from one room to the other, and it gets to that issue that one
doctors
hears
absolutely have time to sit and talk with patients, and the caller's concern about bedside manner inadequacies is one that many medical schools are quite directly addressing. There is time in the U.S. medical school curriculum to work on resolving this problem. Studies of American physicians show that the typical U.S. doctor interrupts a patient trying to describe their symptoms in, on average, 8 seconds into the patient's story. You can teach people not to do that. At Duke, we do that by using what are called standardized patients. These are paid actors who act out the role of patients, are observed by mentors through one-way mirrors, and then the students are critiqued as to how they talk to these standardized patients, and they watch themselves on videotape. You can teach people to sit down when they talk to patients rather than stand up. You can teach people not to put their hands on the doorknob of the door as if they wanted to leave, or not to look at the chart, instead to make eye contact with the patient.
How long has Duke been doing that type of training? One hears that different schools have different reputations of old style, of you treat the disease. That's what you're there to do as a doctor. You're trying to treat the disease, get rid of those symptoms, and make the patient better, not so much to treat the patient as a whole, the more touchy-feely side of things that people would like to have, perhaps, but one hears that there different schools have had different reputations through the years of their approach. Has this been a change at Duke?
I have been vice dean for 4 years, and before that was chairman of the curriculum committee, and have been on the faculty for 22 years. And in my entire time at Duke, we have had specific course training in improved bedside skills. The use of standardized patients in the United States is about 15 years old, and we were among the early schools to do that. So it's not a new concept. And I suppose, you know, one's response to the caller is better to light a candle than curse the dark. We recognize the problem and we're working on it. One should say finally, however, that working on it in medical school is necessary but not sufficient. It wouldn't hurt practicing physicians to go back and retrain in these skills from time to time also.
You're smiling when you say that. Is that because you think it's a long shot to get docs to go back and get some sensitivity training?
No, I don't think it's a long shot at all. We have begun a program at Duke in communications skills in which we direct the teaching towards the professoriate, not to the students. Because if you teach the students the right thing to do, but they observe their mentors doing something else, they will quickly unlearn what you think is the right thing to do. So you have to make sure that the mentors actually model the behaviors you want the students to emulate.
The medical practice rather than the medical preach there.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to Gary, who's in Chapel Hill. Gary, I understand that you're a doctor?
Yes.
Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you. The concern I have is I have two teenage sons who want to go to medical school. Are you getting me?
Yes, we hear you loud and clear.
Okay. And since they started high school, they've known other kids who want to go to medical school, and it is a grind. They are completely focused on this. And they go to college, and it's a grind. And they're just focused on this. They're taking the pre-medical courses. I got a degree in art history before I went to medical school. Best thing I ever did. When I went for my interviews to medical school, I had something to talk about. And it's given me a perspective that helps me relate to patients, to people in general. I have something in my life besides medicine. And I think they should just flat stop the pre-med major. They should make people get a degree in something useful or something that means something to them before sending them off to spend, you know, what is it, another 8 years learning to be a doctor.
Alan Hamrick, you deal with med students, among other students at UNC, for counseling and psychological services. Would that be advice that you think would be well taken by those who are starting out their college careers with an idea eventually of being a doctor to do something radically different from pre-med?
Absolutely. In fact, I can say that UNC values that breadth of experience in students. Is it Gary? Is that the caller?
Yes.
Yeah. One of the things that Gary said about having something in his life other than medicine is one of the things that we try to stress at UNC. When Ed Halpern was talking a while ago and talking about being able to put this stuff in the curriculum to help a student have a better bedside manner, I agree with that. The skills of not touching the doorknob, the skills of not standing up at the wrong time, not interrupting the patient, can be learned within a four-year curriculum. I think it's the sense of the physician or the resident or the medical student that in fact they are well-rounded, that in fact they do have a balance in their life between not just the intellectual but also their own physical health and their emotional health and their spiritual health, that gives them the sense that they do have breadth of experience as well. That helps them communicate with the patient, and it also gives them that sense that in fact they are living a full life as a physician, so that they don't end up in some way resenting the patient because the patient is the reason that they're in the hospital for so long. And we start from the very first day that the medical students come in for their orientation, I speak to them about this balance and that the natural tendency is going to be for them to recognize that they've come from an education where if they've just come from undergraduate, they're used to being able to know 100% of the material that they need to know in order to confirm that they're going to be able to make a good grade. Once they get to medical school, that's just not possible. And it's a very difficult thing because they're used to knowing all that information and being sure that they're going to do well. So when they get to medical school and they recognize there's not enough time to get that information, they first give up the physical, and then they give up the things that keep their emotional health, and then they give up the things that keep their spiritual health, and they begin to get unbalanced at that point. And so we talk to them on the very first day about this and give them access to counseling and psychologic service to be able to talk about these things. And they frequently come to me within the first 2 or 3 months and say, "You're right, here's what's happening, what do I do about this?" And what they do about it in the first and second year is very different because of the way the curriculum is set, and what they do about it in the third year, and then what they do about it in the fourth year, and then what they do about it in residency.
I'm not going to ask you to break doctor-patient confidentiality here, but generally speaking, it sounds like there's barely any time in these med students' lives when they're in med school. And so they come to you for psychological services. Is it easier to prescribe a drug to take rather than therapy? That would take time to talk things through.
You know, a drug is faster than therapy. I think that the effectiveness of treating a person's imbalance is probably better serving them to be done in therapy, because it's addressing the balance issue. It's not just chemically altering them. Does a first year or second year medical student have time to go to weekly or twice weekly psychotherapy? I mean, they can fit it in, but sometimes that often just adds to the increase in stress because they feel like they're giving time to that they ought to be giving to the studies. So I think in this particular culture, at this particular time in this culture, there is a tendency for all of us, medical or not medical, to think, I need to fix this quick because I don't have time to fix it in a well-balanced way. And a pill will bring me back within 2 to 3 weeks, and then I can keep pushing forward towards my goal without breaking step. And one of the things that I try to do and that all of us here try to do when we're working with them is say, let's think about what's going to serve you short-term and also what's going to serve you long-term to be a better person and a better doctor. Because by being a better person and a more well-rounded person, that's ultimately going to lead you to be a better doctor.
Ed Halpern?
The conversation has turned a bit afield from what Gary was talking about in regards to his children and his art history major. I'd want to come back and respond on 3 points. First, one must recognize that there are certain prerequisites which one must complete before entering medical school. You cannot take physiology and biochemistry and anatomy and neurosciences without a fundamental core of knowledge of college-level physics, English writing skills, chemistry through organic chemistry, mathematics through calculus, biostatistics, etc. And while I am in favor of a liberal education, I would not advise someone who is interested in medical school to neglect the necessary prerequisites for a medical curriculum. Second, we must remember that not all medical students are ultimately seeking a career as bedside clinicians. We are also training physician scientists. And for someone whose goal is to explore the human genome or the function of the brain or musculoskeletal pathophysiology, these individuals will follow a tract which will concentrate in the sciences in the hope of generating new knowledge to improve our healthcare. And I would say finally that while I recognize that medical school is stressful, it is stressful because it is a serious, important, life-saving subject. And most medical students do emotionally quite well. Studies on the incidence of depression, on the incidence of psychiatric diagnoses made during the course of medical school show that these are real problems, but relatively infrequent. A recent article in the Journal of the American Medical Association addressed this. Medical students do need time to explore things outside of medicine, but most of them do just fine.
1-877-962-9862 is our number. We're talking about the training that doctors get in the U.S. With us is Ed Halpern from Duke University School of Medicine and Alan Hamrick, who is with the Counseling and Psychological Services at UNC Chapel Hill and is a liaison to med students there. Joining us right now on the phone is Norton Hadler. He's a professor of medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, author of The Last Well Person, How to Stay Well Despite the Healthcare System. He also practices and teaches medicine in Europe and joins us now. Welcome, Norton Hadler.
Thank you, Melinda. It's a privilege.
Well, is the training that doctors get, say, in Europe where you have taught, is it markedly different from the training that doctors get in the U.S.?
Boy, that's a difficult question. Medicine is not a fixed subject because medicine changes, and so does medical education. And it's also very culturally based, so there are distinct differences across the European countries, distinct from us. But you have to realize that we entered the 20th century gifted with two traditions, the French tradition at the bedside and the Prussian tradition in the laboratory. And we took it to heights that no one could imagine by the 60s, 70s, and 80s. We were having a medical education that prepared physicians in a way that wasn't possible in generations before, prepared physicians to be really worthy of the trust of a fellow human being who needed help with a health issue, and physicians who understood the limits of certainty, physicians who took as their goal the caring of the patient. And right now in our country, we're having trouble maintaining that tradition. Other countries had copied us. In fact, it was fascinating what, as a teacher for years in London and Paris and Kyoto and Israel, we were the model. And now I'm not so sure we're the model, and that's because we've been, as educators, brutalized by the corporatization of American medicine. In fact, our teaching institutions are very devoted to process, to the business model of how much work can we do per unit time. and not to the model of, are we sure what we're doing is right, and can we talk with our students across generations about the limitations and certainty?
Mm-hmm.
So we're faced with a watershed time in American medical education that really doesn't relate to the curriculum. It relates to the ability to educate for a lifetime of education, which is what you will go to medical school for. It's a privilege to be a physician. It is hard work, not in medical school. It is hard work throughout your life.
Is there one thing, before we go, is there one thing that you would suggest that American medical schools could do to improve the experience?
We need a clarion call that it is a medical school's principal reason for existing is to educate the student in the optimal care of the patient, so that there is time to do that, there is time to interact, so that students and residents don't feel lonely, so that there are faculty around to talk and not everybody is rushing to see the next patient in 12 minutes. And I am very fond of Ed Halpern and I hear him fully, but I don't think that you can teach ethics in a one-hour course. You have to model ethics, and I don't think you can teach communication with a model patient as well as you can by spending time with people who are trying for years and years to be good at it.
Well, Norton Hadler, thank you so much for joining us. Norton Hadler is a professor of medicine at UNC Chapel Hill and author of The Last Well Person, How to Stay Well Despite the Healthcare System. We will continue our conversation with Ed Halpern, Vice Dean of the School of Medicine at Duke University, and talk about the teaching of ethics. And also Alan Hamrick, Associate Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at UNC. And we will get to more of your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862 on the State of Things. The State of Things comes to you from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and we're talking this hour about training doctors in North Carolina and the U.S. With us is Edward Halpern. He's Vice Dean of the School of Medicine at Duke. And Alan Hamrick is Associate Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at UNC Chapel Hill, who is a liaison especially to medical students. And we are taking your calls. The number is 1-877-962-9862. Before the break, we heard from Dr. Norton Hadler, Edward Halpern, who challenged the idea of teaching ethics to med students in a 1-hour course, and that more needed to be done, and communication skills were, if I'm to paraphrase here, we're getting a somewhat short shrift for those doctors in training.
When I was a resident at the Massachusetts General Hospital, I had a professor who said that he didn't understand why we had to teach medical ethics. Medical ethics, he said, was just common sense. And I knew then that he was wrong, but it took me 30 years to understand why he was wrong. And why he was wrong was not that it wasn't about being sensible, it was about the common part, that there are so few things which are held as common bodies of knowledge in a diverse culture that you couldn't assume at all that it was common sense. You can teach medical ethics in the sense that you can teach people how to have an approach to reasonable, culturally sensitive thinking about problems. And you can do that in a combination of lectures, in case-based learning, in acting out problems, and in doing some creative things. I was at a meeting last week of the Association of American Medical Colleges and began work on a project to use art museums to teach medical students how to look at things with a better eye and really observe, and worked on techniques about learning how to use the Terry Schiavo case as a jumping off point for talking about questions of life and death and respirators.
Would that kind of subject, the Terry Schiavo case, for instance, I know that got lots and lots of play among the lay public, people who are not medically trained. Would that not just have been a subject of conversation in med schools anyway? Or am I perceiving that med schools aren't focusing on that, on the news of the day? They're just the grind of learning everything that's in the textbook is the job one for med students.
Well, the question of when does life end, when should respirators be employed, when should artificial stimulation of the heart be used, have been questions that academic medicine has been grappling with for a long time. It dates to our investigations really of the notion of organ transplantation and when one should harvest organs and transplant them. So the Schiavo case is, for academic medicine, part of a 40-year ongoing conversation about this, a conversation which gets changed as technology changes.
We go to Dr. Turian, who is on the line. Hi there. Thanks for joining us. Hello. Hi. Hello.
I like to bring another point of view, which I believe is very, very critical, and that is that any physician who is going to be learning ethics when he comes to medical school has got a tough job, because our selection process rewards those people who get A grades in every course they take before they come to medical school, and that's why they're chosen. And the medical center treats patients as clients, and it's a business proposition. And they're following the model of the medical center, then they're not going to become people who have sensitivity to the real critical issue, that whereas you can be a scientist and a physician, ultimately what makes that difference is not whether you're a scientist or a physician, is whether you have an inner conscience. And you cannot, in my view, you cannot do that by process, by saying, this is the way you should do it, here is an example, that's the way you end up doing it. This is something which is fundamental, because if we select those people who are character disorders, those people who are motivated by money, those people who are motivated by ambition, we're going to end up with a different set of people who come to medical school in the first place.
If I could just ask you a question, though, Turian. The idea, though, of weeding people out who get anything less than A grades, I mean, how does that contribute to an ethics problem?
Well, because you're constantly confronted with what is the best thing you can do for a patient and what is your responsibility for that patient and how can you put yourself in his place and say, if you were a patient, how would you like to be treated? And I doubt that this is the model we follow when we take care of patients in a hospital, because there's a constant pressure to see people, get them out of the way and get them on their way. And this isn't going to be done. Also, I think it's great to talk about ethics, but when you go to a medical center and ask yourself, what is your professor doing? What is the chairman of the department doing? What is the chief leadership doing in terms of how are they taking care of patients, that I should follow their model? I think all of us as professors of medicine, whatever we are, we're very wanting, because that's not the way we treat people.
Are there also people out there who would say, it's very nice to have a doctor who will be touchy-feely and spend a lot of time at my bedside, but I want somebody who knows the goods, regardless of how well he communicates.
Not talking about touchy-feeling. That's a whole different problem. That's a pseudo response to a patient's need to be treated as in a warm manner. I'm talking about fundamental issue of what is the level of conscience you have in which your responsibility to this patient is not by pretense, but by real essence of how you are, what kind of a human being you are, and how you're willing to treat people. And that's a whole different dimension of how we treat people.
Okay, I'm going to put your question, thank you for your call, to Edward Halpern.
Dr. Turian is raising a crucial question about medical school admissions. What do you look for when you have 5,000 applications at Duke for 100 seats in the medical class? And how do you decide who gets the fat envelope in the spring? Well, you could have a completely objective system in which you simply total up people's A's, B's, and C's and their performance on the medical college admissions test. That would be a system which would be transparent and would be, in one sense, equitable, but it would be insufficient. So we try to address some of the questions Dr. Turian has raised. We have people submit large numbers of letters of recommendation. We have them write essays on topics in ethics. We have them go through at least two interviews in which one interviewer is specifically enjoined to try to understand the person's take on humanism and communications and ethics. But it's not a perfect system, but it is a system which we try to make both as fair, as academically rigorous as possible, and as careful to people's person-to-person skills as possible. I wish I could tell Dr. Turian it was perfect. It's not. But becoming is sometimes superior to being. We're working on it.
Okay, we go to Melanie in Nags Head. Hi, Melanie.
Hello, how are you today?
Fine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I would just like to encourage the educators as well as the students to remember that when dealing with a patient, that part of that whole patient care is including and listening to family. From personal experience, my father has problems that prohibit him from remembering things very accurately. For the most part, I must say we have been listened to as family members. However, recently we had an experience when a physician said, I don't have time to talk to you. Can't you know I have patients in here to take care of? So there is more than just listening to the patient in some instances.
Ed Halpern?
The caller, as well as some of the previous callers, is touching upon what some people think is a fundamental problem, and that is the notion that we have developed what we call health care delivery systems and what Dr. Hadler called the corporatization of medicine. And I think they're right. We have a problem where in medical systems, care has become a noun and not a verb. We think we can deliver care in little utils in 12 to 15 minute blocks, and that people will measure our relative value units and compensate our healthcare providers by how many of these utils they generate. It's a model based on assembly line manufacturing techniques, and it doesn't work. I think that the great problem of medical education is our risk of forgetting what business we're really in. And the business we're really in is remembering that to care is a verb, not a noun, and that our real business is to generate, conserve, and disseminate new knowledge about the causes, prevention, and treatment of human disease. And when people have bad experiences, such as are being described, it is indicative of what Dr. Hadler referred to as corporatization of the medical model.
Alan Hamrick, did you want to jump in there?
I would agree that including the family is very important, and in some ways making it less corporate or less business is important, but it is being run in the same way that the rest of our culture is frequently being run, which is that money is driving it, and that is part of the reason that we're trying to help the students learn as much as they can to be using their head and their heart at the same time.
1-877-962-9862 is our number. Philip is in Cary. Hi there, Philip.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So where are you coming from on this? Are you a patient, a doctor? What's your take on the training?
Both. I'm trained as a doctor of pharmacy, a PharmD, and I'm a former faculty member at the medical school at UNC through the AHEC system, and I worked in family medicine. However, now I am a patient. I've been disabled since 1997, secondary to chronic pain. And I have discovered, being on the other side of the fence, that many physicians do not deal very well with patients in chronic pain. And I have experienced it both Duke and UNC with in this regard, dating back to the before 2000.
Are you speaking here of a reluctance to prescribe painkillers, or
yes, a reluctance to treat the whole patient that has chronic pain, a great fear of the use of narcotics in patients who have no history of alcohol or drug abuse.
I'm going to put your question, or your comment to Ed Halpern here. What kind of training do doctors get about, palliative care, of giving patients those things, those treatments that would take the edge off, the pain away?
We have a specific course in Duke Medical School in palliative medicine But the caller, in my opinion, is absolutely right. A problem nationally in the United States is adequate training in pain management. This country does relatively poorly at the administration of both pharmacologic and surgical interventions for pain. Often in medical schools, the management of chronic pain falls between the cracks of different departments, and it is an area which must be addressed. It's an area, however, which must be addressed not only in medical schools, but in other aspects of the healthcare delivery system. Recent studies, for example, show that if an oncologist writes a prescription in the island of Manhattan for narcotic medication for a cancer patient, a significant proportion of pharmacies do not carry the drugs and will not fill the prescription because they don't want to have narcotics in stock because of the concern about theft. Another problem concerns the relative imposition of drug control laws, where physicians are worried about being charged with excessive dissemination of drugs. This problem of pain management, as the caller alludes, is a big problem which requires attention on many fronts.
Okay. We go to Sarah now, who I understand, Sarah, you're a med student.
Yes, I am a first-year med student at Duke.
Great. Well, thank you for taking time out to join us. I understand it's a rather grueling schedule. So,
yes.
What's your take on all of this?
Well, my take is from somebody who went into medicine for all of the sort of touchy-feely reasons of, you know, giving patients the very best care and all of that stuff. But this year, I've also met the whole range of people who are planning on going into, you know, high-powered kind of public policy ambitions or scientific research ambitions. And of course, the Duke first-year curriculum is really rigorous. We're doing all the basic sciences in only 1 year. So, but I think that Duke has done a wonderful job of finding ways to integrate all of the ethical stuff, all of the humanistic parts of medicine into the curriculum sort of throughout the day by integrating it into all of our science classes, by giving us role models through the people who teach our practice course, which is a course in which we sort of learn the art of medicine, and also by funding a lot of really interesting talks and lunchtime discussions and just sort of ways for us to get the discussion going throughout the year.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Sarah.
My pleasure.
Before we go, Ed Halpern, if you've been in this business for decades, if there were a change that you would like to see made in the medical training that doctors get in the U.S. and inside of a minute, could you tell me what it would be?
I would emphasize the use of simulators more. The U.S. has a tradition of bedside teaching and hands-on learning, but we don't let people fly airplanes with passengers on board unless they've flown simulators for hundreds of hours. We don't let military personnel operate tanks unless they've trained on simulators.
So you're talking robots?
Yeah, I'm talking about $250,000 computerized mannequins in which you can learn how to draw blood, put a chest tube in, intubate. These mannequins breathe and it feels like their hearts are beating and their pulses are working, and you can make mistakes on mannequins and do it over and over again so you get it right and analyze your mistakes. And an important aspect for medical education will be to invest in improved computer systems for training so that it becomes second nature, so that by the time you get to the patient, you're so confident you're able to talk.
Thank you both for being with us today, Ed Halpern and Alan Hamrick. Edward Halpern is Vice Dean of the School of Medicine at Duke University, and Alan Hamrick is Associate Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at UNC Chapel Hill. And that's the state of things for today. If you have a comment about our program, you can send us an email here at sot@wunc.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thanks for listening. I'm Melinda Pencava.